I'd like to thank the University of Sussex for inviting me to the university at the end of 2006 and for giving me the opportunity to present this lecture. Amongst many other strengths in social and economic history, two important historical traditions have made Sussex a renowned place for studying history. First, Sussex pioneered the study of intellectual history, in which scholars such as Donald Winch, Stephen Collini and John Burrow worked with great distinction for many decades. Currently, as many people here know, I'm part of the Centre for Intellectual History, enjoying working with my colleagues Richard Watmore and Knud Harkinson. But I'd like to point to another tradition, or rather to an extraordinary coincidence, by which three major historians of millennial belief happened to be present at Sussex in the 1960s and 1970s. In his Pursuit of the Millennium of 1957, Norman Cohn argued that passages and images in the Book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, showed how in times of economic and social crisis, many medieval and early modern movements were galvanized by those passages in the Book of Revelation, and to a lesser extent, the Old Testament Book of Daniel, that promised a future rule of 1,000 years, a millennium, for downtrodden and persecuted saints. There would be a battle between the good and the bad, the former massively outnumbered by the latter, which God's chosen few were destined to win. There were clear parallels, Cohn thought, between these medieval views, or expressed in Revelation, and the need for a messianic leader preaching the doctrine of the final struggle and the coming of the new age that could be found in contemporary totalitarian regimes. Ultimately, Cohn attributed the formation of these radical political movements to a psychosocial pathology that expressed itself as the megalomania of the elect, his word. Cohn arrived at Sussex in 1963 to become director of the Columba Centre for Studies of Persecution and Genocide. And 4 years later, he published Warrant for Genocide, a study of the forged protocols of the Elders of Zion. He continued to pursue innovative research on the apocalypse, and among a number of later works, in 1994, he published Cosmos, Chaos and the World to Come, a work that examined apocalyptic beliefs among a number of different peoples in the ancient Near East, ultimately deriving from 2nd century before the Common Era strains of Zoroastrianism. It's a great book. At the end of the 1970s, two other Sussex historians produced influential works on Christian views of the millennium. In his book, The Second Coming of 1979, John Harrison used the millenarian beliefs of people between 1780 and 1850 to examine what he called popular culture, arguing that the massive explosion in interest in the apocalypse in the same period was not the perverse or preserve of a lunatic fringe, but was a manifestation in both Britain and the US of increasingly powerful Protestant evangelicalism, and was a means of coming to terms with the massive changes posed by industrialization. Finally, in two major works, one of 1979 and again last, 2 years ago in 2006, William Lamont has examined the significance of the apocalypse for the great Puritan divine Richard Baxter, and has written recently a history of the Muggletonian sect, founded in 1652 by the eponymous man who believed he was one of the two witnesses in Revelation, and whose last member, a Kent farmer called Philip Noakes, died in that same year of 1979. In both cases, Lamont immersed himself in the unpublished writings of figures who were heterodox but neither political radicals nor religious fanatics, unless you count as insane Lodowick Muggleton's view that cursing was beneficial to health. In the rest of this lecture, I want to briefly outline the apocalyptic tradition that was so important to Englishmen from the middle of the 16th century. I look at the development of this tradition and its continuation after the end of the Cromwellian regime in the 1650s. Although we now know that apocalyptic interest did not subside with the restoration of 1660, and indeed it was of great concern to religious conservatives as well as radicals in the later 17th century, a sense of impending crisis was never far beneath the surface of apocalyptic exegesis. Even in times of relative tranquility, Revelation licensed the view that there was always ongoing an immensely significant battle between good and evil. And it foretold of terrible things happening to those who found themselves on the wrong team. I go on to look in more detail at the work of one interpreter, Isaac Newton, who combined a position as a Cambridge don with a self-imposed identity as a lay interpreter of Scripture. Although references to contemporary events are non-existent in Newton's prophetic writings, his belief that he was one of the elect to be identified with the saints and martyrs of centuries gone by energized his remarkable analysis of Revelation. Revelation lay at the heart of Newton's lifelong study of Scripture, and his immense schematic understanding of the images and of the events he believed they described provided a deeply radical twist on what was by then a familiar apocalyptic story. I start, somewhat hilariously, with a guide to the text itself. Why has it been such an influential resource for action in the West over the last millennium? What, in God's name, is in it? Revelation begins with St. John, so you're going to get 5 minutes, or 7 minutes as it turns out, I hope, on the revelation of St. John, and you're going to learn it's a very wacky text indeed. Revelation begins with St. John sitting on the island of Patmos. These are pictures which I hope you can see. This is him on his way to Patmos in a boat from a medieval text, and this is him sitting on the island of Patmos, receiving a vision of someone who resembles the Son of Man. After which John rises to get a first-hand glimpse of someone else sitting on a throne which emits lightning, thunder, and various voices. 4 beasts and 24 elders surround the throne. You can see at the top if this thing works, which it obviously won't now. Yes, it does. These are the 24 elders. I haven't got time to find the beasts, I'm afraid. They surround the throne and give thanks to the person who sits on it. John notes that the man on the throne has a book with 7 seals and is told that he is the only one who can open it. Next, he witnesses a slain lamb. Who's that little object there? Which is there? A slain lamb. Who's taking the book from the man on the throne, and the lamb opens the first 4 seals of the book in turn. Each seal reveals a different coloured horseman. But when the 5th seal, these are 2 of the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse, of course, a white, a red, a black, and a pale man. But when the 5th seal is opened, John sees the souls of all those lying under an altar who have been slain for the word of God. These people are begging God to tell them why they have not yet been avenged, but they're given white robes and they're told to wait until many more like them have been killed. The opening of the 6th seal presents a vision of an earthquake, a blackened sun, and a blood-red moon. The stars fall, mountains and islands are moved, and all the powerful people on earth hide, fearful of the wrath of the Lamb and of the man who sits on the throne. Central to the radical Protestant traditions were the next images, in which 4 angels, all standing on the 4 corners of the earth, actually these are the people at the bottom who are hiding from the wrath of God, bottom right, and then we have angels who are standing on the 4 corners of the earth and holding back the winds that they are controlling. You can just see the winds blowing at the top. They're holding back winds until the 144,000 servants of God are sealed in their foreheads. Right in the middle of this, there are various angels who are sealing people in the middle of their foreheads with the mark of God. These 144,000 are the conventional elect, which are described in both sects and orthodox Christian movements. John sees a large number of people in white robes, all singing praise to God and the Lamb, and he tells one of the 24 elders that their robes have been washed clean in the blood of the Lamb. They will hunger and thirst no more, and God will wipe the tears from their eyes. When the 7th seal is opened on the right-hand side, there's half an hour's silence. On the top left, you can see that the angels are not blowing their trumpets. They're witnessing, testifying to the half an hour's silence. But then after this, the 7 angels successively sound their trumpets. When the 2nd angel sounds, which you can see on the left-hand side, a remarkable picture from the 1530s, a great mountain-sized object is thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turns to blood, a third of all sea creatures perish, and a third of all ships are lost. Vast numbers of people are killed when the 3rd trumpet sounds, while in the 4th, which you can see on the right-hand side, a third part of each of the sun, the moon, and the stars are ravaged. You can just about see the moon on the top left and the sun on the top right. An angel now sings, woe, 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 to those remaining on earth, for there is much more destruction to come. When the fifth angel sounds, an angel is given a key to a bottomless pit, which is opened, and from this smoke and locusts emerge. The locusts are coming out of the pit on the bottom right-hand side. They are medieval locusts and not ones that one currently knows anything about. When the sixth trumpet is blown, 200 million horsemen are let loose from the river Euphrates to destroy a third of mankind. Yet the survivors, the text says, repent not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, nor of their murders, sorceries, fornication and theft. John is now shown a smaller book by an angel. It's a remarkable picture from the 1830s. You can just about see the angel through the white haze. Well, I think you can. And he's told to eat this book. He's ordered to continue prophesying once he's eaten the book. The following visions involve John being given a measuring rod, which is up here. It's that thing there going up there. It's a measuring rod. By which he measures the temple of God, though he's told to avoid measuring the court which exists outside the temple. In Christian thinking, the temple inside the court stands for the place where the godly are safe, and the court on the outside stands for the bestial Gentiles who are going to attempt to tread this temple underfoot. He's told that the Gentiles will tread the city underfoot for 42 months. In another vision, the same angel says to John that he will give power to two witnesses who will prophesy in sackcloth for 1,260 days, and they're given certain powers to smite the wicked on earth whenever they want. At the end of this period, however, a beast will rise from the pit. And there's a picture of a beast at the bottom. It looks rather tame with the two witnesses. And he'll make war against them until they're dead. At the bottom right there, you can see that one of the witnesses has unfortunately fallen foul of the beast. After they're dead, they'll remain lifeless for 3.5 days, but after that they'll be resurrected and taken up to heaven. And the people that had mocked their dead bodies and laughed and engaged in fun and games will be decimated and wiped clean. In the following vision, a woman clothed with the sun, bedecked with a crown of 12 stars, is in labour. She's lying on the ground in labour. But immediately there's another image, this time of a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, which is ready to devour the child as soon as it's born. As soon as it's born, the child turns out to be a man who is to rule the nations with a rod of iron, and he's immediately whisked up to heaven, while the woman flees to the wilderness for 1,260 days. Next, there's an image of a war in heaven between Michael and the dragon. There's Michael and the dragon down below. After which the battered dragon, otherwise known as the devil, is cast down onto earth. Those in heaven are able to rejoice, but those on earth are warned to beware the wrath of the devil. The latter now undertakes to persecute the woman in the wilderness. Unable to drown the woman with water spewing from his mouth, the dragon now seeks to make war with the remnant who have the testimony of Jesus. Next, John sees a 10-horned beast arise from the sea, one of whose 7 heads is wounded. And that's a picture of a very nasty looking devil. That's a joke. It's not that nasty looking. The dragon heals the wounded head and gives the beast power and authority. All the people not written in the book of life begin to worship it. And having been given 42 months to live, that's 1,260 days in lunar months, it blasphemes God and his saints. Notably, it's given the power to make war with and overcome the saints, according to Revelation. Soon another beast appears, this time with 2 horns, and he performs miracles, telling the people left on earth to worship the first beast. This false prophet creates an image of the first beast, making it appear to come to life. There's an image from the early 1640s of the Pope sitting on top of the 7-headed beast of Rome. The false prophet creates an image of the beast, as we've heard. All those not worshipping the first beast, the second beast says, are going to be killed, and the survivors will be marked with the number of the name of the beast, which, as you all know, is 666. By means of countertype, John's vision now switches to Mount Zion, where the Lamb of God stands with the 144,000 elect. They're all virgins who will follow the Lamb wherever he goes. angels now appear saying that those who worship the beast and his image and who had the mark of the beast will receive the wrath of God. John now sees the image of someone who looks like the Son of Man sitting on a cloud, who reaps the earth with his sickle. This is called the harvest. This is followed by the actions of another angel who gathers vines for the winepress of God's wrath, the blood wine of which is then let loose. Next, John witnesses the pouring out of the seven vials of God's wrath. That's an image of the devil. All these vials cause hideous devastation on earth. The third, for example, is poured. These are the seven vials of wrath from Holbein. The third vial, for example, is poured on all the rivers and fountains, which become blood. After this, an angel tells God how righteous he has been, because those who have suffered so terribly had shed the blood of saints and prophets. With the fourth vial, men are scorched with great heat from the sun, but they continue to blaspheme the name of God, while the sixth vial is poured out over the river Euphrates, which dries up immediately. John then sees an image of three frogs jumping out of the mouths of the dragon. You can just about see these frogs there on the bottom left-hand side. The beast and the false prophet. The frogs are the spirit of devils, Revelation says, who work miracles and collect people to fight for their cause at Armageddon. When the seventh vial is poured out, a voice from heaven calls out, "It is done," and there is pandemonium on earth. Entire cities fall, and islands and mountains disappear, while a giant hailstorm falls from the heaven. The following images concern the Whore of Babylon. The Whore of Babylon is on the right of that picture, sitting on top of a dragon. She's dressed in purple and scarlet, and she's bedecked with gold and pearls, holding a golden cup containing the filthy results of her fornication. Those are the words of Revelation, not my opinion. She's drunk with the blood of saints and martyrs. An angel tells John that the Whore is a great city and that all nations are implicated in her fornication. But he's advised by another angel that Babylon will soon fall. To the great regret of many merchants, kings and other idolaters, Babylon is indeed destroyed, and the blood of saints and prophets is discovered in her remains. The final images in Revelation indicate the presence of a saviour on a white horse with a sword coming out of his mouth, ready to rule the people with a rod of iron, and a description of the new Jerusalem that awaits the righteous. The dragon, otherwise known as the devil, is locked up in the bottomless pit. And you see him being locked up in the bottomless pit for 1,000 years. There's another picture there of him being trampled down into the bottomless pit for 1,000 years, with the proviso that at the end of the period, he has to be let loose for a short time. This indeed comes to pass, but God has seemingly had enough of the entire sorry tale that I've just been telling you. And Satan is cast back into a lake of fire and brimstone to be tormented alongside the beast and the false prophet for eternity. There is a great day of judgment. This is the greatest depiction of the day of judgment that we have by William Blake, in which all those who have died so far are judged according to their works, and those not in the book of life are cast into a lake of fire to accompany the devil, the false prophet, and all the others. Another image reveals that there is now no more temple inside a city, walling off the righteous from the ungodly, for now all are with the Lamb and the God. Finally, in a very important passage, an angel shows John the pure water of life, besides which there is a tree of life, which has 12 different kinds of fruit. This was a strange text. The church fathers debated whether it was canonical and decided that even if it was, then the text should only be interpreted with great care. The medieval church held itself to be an instantiation of the millennial prophecy, that is, the prophecy that referred to the 1,000 years when Christ would rule with his saints. If the church was the fulfillment of this prophecy, then nearly all the images referred to the time of the early church when Christians were bloodily persecuted by pagan Roman emperors. Sometimes, in the medieval church, the persecutions of the 5th and 6th centuries by the Vandals, the Goths, and the Huns that had created so many saints in the Catholic tradition were understood through the images of the trumpets and vials, but large-scale systematic treatments of Revelation were extremely rare in the medieval period. Occasionally too, as Norman Cohn pointed out, radical movements arose that attached more lurid images to the actions of their enemies, and they took refuge in the hope endorsed in a number of places in Revelation, that it was the destiny of the elect to be persecuted. Although the apocalypse provided a language of hope for many medieval radicals, the early reformers were hesitant about invoking its powerful images. Luther famously denounced the work as neither apostolic nor prophetic in the early 1520s, but when presented with the examples of numerous Protestant martyrs in the later part of the decade, which indicated to him that they were living in the latter days, he revised his opinion. Very quickly, Revelation became a cornerstone of Protestantism. Revelation told of the historical fight between the true, unadulterated religion and the Catholic Church, to the latter of which Islam also played a major supporting role. Christianity had been perverted by the devil, Protestants thought, a process that could be dated back to the centuries after Constantine became emperor of Rome in the early 4th century. Images in Revelation that spoke of idolatry, and in particular the worship of images, pointed firmly to the historical culpability of Roman Catholicism. Rome was Babylon, and numerous images in Revelation seemed to clearly depict what Protestants thought was the carnal and base trade of Catholicism. Agreement on essentials like this did not mean, of course, that there were not major disagreements over how specific images were to be interpreted and related. Another dimension was provided by the explosive appearance of a Protestant martyrological tradition, created during a period when thousands of Protestants of various beliefs went joyously to a death performed by burning, hanging, drowning, or beheading. Against the immensely powerful and visual Catholic hagiographic tradition, in which individual saints were associated with particular days of the year, persecuted Protestants, both male and female, chose to die according to the ancient pattern of martyrdom indicated in the Bible and exemplified most exclusively by Christ's own death on the cross. Thousands of pamphlets appeared from the late 1520s, depicting the godly and gruesome deaths of individuals who had become martyrs through their patience in the face of death. Although the preponderance of martyrs justified the belief of Protestants that their religion was true, Protestant leaders were worried about the use of the term saints to describe such heroes. Calvinists in particular were deeply concerned about the potential for idolatry offered by images, or by the idea that texts, images, or even relics might offer intercessionary power. With some justification, Catholic writers accused many devout Protestants of collecting the bones of their martyrs and accused some Protestant martyrologists of telling stories about the achievements of their heroes that were far more fabulous than those that the Protestants condemned as fanciful or ridiculous when written about Catholics. Lutherans and Calvinists also disagreed over whether to encourage martyrdom. Calvin assailed those who lived in Catholic principalities and yet kept silent about their Protestant faith. And indeed, the strongest strains of martyrological discourse are found among followers of Calvin. Lutherans recommended exile rather than martyrdom as a more reasonable goal for ordinary believers. In the 1550s, Protestant writers such as Jean Crespin, Ludwig Rabus, and Adrian van Heemstede compiled lengthy compilations of recent martyrs that also contained a substantial degree of scholarship relating to earlier Christian victims of persecution. Such works could be problematic for two reasons. First, at a time when Lutherans and Calvinists might have reason to fear one another, even more than the Catholic Church, one had to be careful in case doctrinal deviants were accidentally included in a list of martyrs. Secondly, when later editions of these works were extended back to the early church, there was a danger of overlapping with Catholic literature. Strikingly, most of these works went forward from the apostles up to the persecutions under Diocletian, but they stopped with the persecutions of pagan Rome before Constantine made Christianity the most favoured religion in the Roman Empire in the early 4th century. The momentous political and religious events of the 1540s and 50s shaped the development of the English and Scottish apocalyptic tradition. A network of exiles from the regimes of Henry VIII and Queen Mary mixed with other Protestants in places like Strasbourg, Zurich and Basel, and they created complex politico-religious histories, drawing heavily from the imagery in Revelation and reflexively placing themselves at a key juncture in the emerging triumph of the saints. The martyrological and apocalyptic traditions or genres merged in many of the writings in the 1560s and 70s, so that many of the deaths of Protestant martyrs were seen as fulfillments of specific prophecies in Revelation. Central to the English apocalyptic tradition was the work of the Marian exile John Fox, that is a refugee from Queen Mary. In the mid-50s, Fox found himself in Basel and in contact with Jean Crespin, and he, Crespin and others, borrowed narratives from each other for their own biographies of martyrs. On his return to England after the accession of his beloved Queen Elizabeth, Fox was the leading English-speaking martyrologist. In the first edition of his Acts and Monuments of 1563, he joined together the martyrological and apocalyptic traditions. Here he spoke on the title page of Antichrist as rising from the bottomless pit in the year 1000, but later in the same work and in later editions, he moved this to the year 1300, when the millennium ended as far as he was concerned. This was because it was in the 14th century that his heroes Huss and my own ancestor Wycliffe began to preach and to be persecuted by the Roman Church. By the time of the fourth edition of 1583, he added a section dealing with the mystical numbers in Revelation. He worked intensively on the subject after this edition, but his lack of confidence in his results is shown by the fact that he chastised his son Samuel for babbling his views on the apocalypse to someone else before his own project was finished. Nevertheless, these results were published in his Meditations on the Apocalypse, which appeared a few months after he died in 1587. Here he was much more sanguine about attaching dates and events to images in Revelation. The four horsemen of the apocalypse were the four world monarchies in Daniel, while the seals themselves told of the history of the church. The first four trumpets heralded God's successive judgments against persecutors in consecutive order: the Jews, the pagan Roman emperors, the heretics, and the corruptors of Scripture. More significantly, the locusts of the fifth trumpet depicted the fate of the vicious Goths, Lombards, and Huns, while the scorpions in the same image were Muslims. The sixth trumpet and its corresponding vial depicted the rise to power of the Turks and also of the diabolical and persecutory form of the anti-Christian Roman Church. This was the era in which Fox believed he was writing, while the final trumpet and vial described the last judgment, which was reserved for the future. Fox cautioned his readers that the exegesis of Revelation was the job of learned historians, and one should not rashly make predictions concerning the timing of future events. Although Fox had put many prophetic fulfillments too far back in the past for most Protestant interpreters, his views were deeply influential at a time when England was threatened by and then apparently delivered from the Spanish Armada in 1588. In the following decades, both English and Scottish authors amended and built upon Fox's work, repeatedly referring back to his description of martyrs, but also building on the scrutiny of the images and numbers in Scripture. One issue concerned the so-called internal relation of the prophecies. This is what interpreters had to deal with. How was one to link or synchronize the seals, the trumpets, and the vials with other key periods, such as the 1,260 days accorded to the woman's stay in the wilderness, and the prophesying of the two witnesses in sackcloth, and the 42 months in which the Gentiles trod the holy city underfoot? Another issue concerned the application of prophecies to specific events, a process that was supported by a typological tradition in which days meant years and kings, say, referred to individuals or empires, depending on the context. Central to these analyses were the dating of the Great Apostasy, the time when the true religion had become corrupted by diabolical forces. The events in which the seals, trumpets, and vials had been fulfilled in history, and the designations of the various mystical numbers. It was obvious to most Protestant interpreters that the Whore of Babylon and the ten-horned and two-horned beasts referred to the spiritual and temporal aspects of the Catholic Church, while the dragon, as the text explicitly stated, was that old devil himself. But was the 1,000 years of the beast in the bottomless pit to coincide with the millennium, or did it precede it? Which of the two beasts was denoted by the number 666? Protestants argued vigorously amongst themselves about this and attempted to refute the absurd suggestions of Catholic scholars that all this interpretive activity resulted from the perverse fantasies of heretics. By the 1620s, there was a well-established series of techniques and frameworks for understanding the interrelations of apocalyptic images and their application to history. The greatest interpreter of the 17th century was Joseph Meade, 1586 to 1638. Whose work in turn constituted a crucial resource for his Christ College pupils, John Milton and Henry Moore, amongst others. Mead was broadly learned in natural philosophy, mathematics, philology, and theology, and became famous for having demonstrated in his Key to the Apocalypse of 1627 a number of synchronisms in Daniel and Revelation, and for locating a number of others previously undiscovered, without any reference to specific historical events. When he did get down to the business of attaching images to events, Mead held that the first five seals related to pagan Rome, from Christ's death to the conversion of Constantine, whereupon the sixth seal was opened. This general historical outline was by now so well accepted by most interpreters that it was considered absurd and even insane to deny it. The first trumpet was synchronized with the opening of the seventh seal, sounding at the death of Theodosius in 395, whereupon the Roman Empire was divided into East and West for the last time, and now the great apostasy came into being. Mead placed the first trumpets in the seventh seal. Right, we're going to get a picture coming up soon, which is worthy of being explained. These are the seals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is the seventh seal, that big thing at the top. These are the trumpets, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And these are the vials, or the phials. So the first vial starts in the beginning of the sixth trumpet, and the seventh vial starts at the beginning of the seventh trumpet. It's as easy as that. So Mead places the first six trumpets in the seventh seal, namely in the years, and put these down to the years 395, these are the trumpets, 410, the sacking of Rome by the Visigoth Alaric, 476, the start of the reign of a barbarian emperor, then 542, the wars of Belisarius against the remains of the Roman Empire. The last two trumpets, the penultimate and antepenultimate trumpets, referred to the wars of the enemies of Christendom, the Saracens from 630 and the Turks from 1080, and the final trumpet indicated the anti-Christianism of Roman Catholicism. Mead stressed the significance of the 1,260 days of the woman's exile, which is taken conventionally to be the true church not showing its face. And he proved to the satisfaction of many of his readers that the downfall of Antichrist would be about 1,260 years after the sounding of the first trumpet. The fact that this was dated in Mead's scheme to about 1655, you add 1260 to 395, of course, made it an obvious source for many of his followers. The most relevant image was the pouring of the vials. The first, coincided with the sounding of the sixth trumpet, was the teaching of the medieval heretics, according to Mead. The second referred to the rising of Luther, and the third was the killing of Roman Catholics by Protestant princes. In the expanded 1632 edition of his key, he claimed that the recent successes of the Protestant prince Gustavus Adolphus constituted the pouring of the fourth vial, but later followers such as John Evelyn and Samuel Pepys argued that in doing this, he had resolved the matter too hastily. He'd been a bit bleeding previous. The godly would face the continued machinations of the beast until he was bound up at the pouring of the seventh vial, which Mead synchronized with the sounding of the seventh trumpet and the millennial reign of Christ, which you can see there. This was the day of judgment. So for Mead, one day, according to Jesus, is as 1,000 years to us. So the day of judgment just is the millennium. It's the period when the saints would rule on earth. The Apocalypse and its various commentaries were vital in energizing the writings and practices of the mid-17th century radicals in the civil wars and then in the interregnum. Here one might usefully distinguish between the hundreds of pamphlets, almanacs and short books produced by religious and political radicals in the political crises of the 1640s and 50s and the more scholarly tomes that came from the learned. Nevertheless, the boundary between these was porous. The technically sophisticated Mead, whose work was printed by order of Parliament, it was translated by order of Parliament in 1642, had promised and even demonstrated a future millennium, while more orthodox analyses could scarcely ignore the ways in which specific images were of contemporary relevance. Many divines were quick to show how the restoration of Charles II in 1660 was a fulfilment of one or more prophecies in the New Testament, and it was no difficult matter to rearrange Cromwell's name according to the same principles by which people made 666 equal Latinos or Rome in order to show that Cromwell was the manifestation and fulfilment of the name or the number of the name of the beast, 666. However, for at least three decades, historians have been aware that millenarian exegetical work was not the preserve of religious or political radicals, nor was it merely undertaken at times of political crisis. Although it is true that publications peaked during the Popish Plot in the late 1670s and after the Glorious Revolution in 1688-89, the apocalyptic tradition thrived both in private and in the writings of various Anglican apologists. One of the latter was the Cambridge Platonist Henry Moore, who I've already mentioned, who was the most prolific published interpreter of prophecy after the Restoration. After a precarious period in which he was accused of trimming his sails to the Cromwellian regime, Moore made it his business in 1660 to bolster the religious and political authority of the Church of England. His voluminous apocalyptic writings attempted to show that the truths of Revelation could be proved with absolute certainty, what he called mathematical certainty, and he strove to demonstrate against the claims of the sects that the Church of England was the model for future earthly rule of saints in the millennium. Like Mead, he thought that the 1,260 years of the beast's reign had begun in the 390s, thereby placing the end of the beast's reign, fortuitously for Moore in 1660, in the late 1650s. In other prophetical works that he produced over the next two decades, such as his Apocalypsios of 1680, Moore located his discourse in the third vial, originally poured out, he thought, at the defeat of the Armada, but he differed from Mead by placing the vials in the last trumpet. And we'll see, this is Mead's more complicated version of the image that you saw below. And modesty prevents me from spending 2 hours going through it. But essentially, what Moore has done is he's placed the pouring of the vials in the seventh trumpet instead of in the sixth trumpet. By the middle of the 1680s, Moore found himself fighting a battle against people like Richard Baxter, who had claimed in a commentary on the New Testament that most passages in Revelation were of uncertain meaning. Worse, in Moore's eyes, Baxter had absurdly denied that the Pope was Antichrist, even though this had been done with good intentions, since Baxter believed that the papacy had shed too much blood to be Antichrist. Moreover, when Charles II died in March 1685, his Roman Catholic brother ascended the throne, and as James II became the defender of the Church of England. As Moore pondered these problems, his Cambridge colleague and friend Isaac Newton was completing the foundational work in the history of the exact sciences, the Principia Mathematica, a few hundred yards away from where Moore lived, which was ultimately published in 1687. Nevertheless, we now know that at almost exactly the same time as Moore was debating with Baxter on these things, Newton was finessing a system of apocalyptic interpretation that, while based firmly on the work of Mead, was much more radical than anything discussed so far. Newton was brought up in a devout Lincolnshire family during the horrors of the Civil Wars and the discipline of the Commonwealth. When he went to Cambridge in 1661, he went to Trinity College, the same institution at which his maternal uncle had studied. He undoubtedly knew his Bible very well by this stage, and presumably he'd been exposed to a Protestant view of history in many different forms and locations. But by the late 60s, he would have been forced to address the more detailed types of literature involving the study of doctrine and the church fathers. His early theological notes show an interest in various doctrines and practices of Catholicism, and also show a concern with patristic accounts of the nature of Christ. At some point, however, he went beyond the standard anti-Catholic abusive positions that would be expected of a Protestant student, and he came to loathe the central elements of Orthodox theology, most notably the doctrine of the co-equality of the Holy Trinity. To make this clear, he believes that God is completely different and separate from the other two members of the Holy Trinity. He's utterly unlike, physically, his Son, Jesus Christ. Not only was the Holy Trinity false, according to Newton, but a detailed examination of church history would reveal just how the pristine apostolic religion had been corrupted by Catholic Trinitarians, most notably in the 4th and 5th centuries after Christ. For Newton, the Book of Revelation, the most important book in the Bible, repaid detailed and concentrated study. The works of Mead and Moore were used as bases for grasping the more detailed order of the prophecies, and they also pointed to ways in which individual images and descriptions could be related to specific historical events. To this tradition, Newton now added a rigorous, if exceptionally unorthodox, study of the Fathers, which gave detailed information about the sort of history of the Church Newton now believed to be true. His pronounced anti-Catholicism and his commitment to a severely heretical anti-Trinitarian view, in which God was immeasurably greater than his Son, conditioned the way in which he understood the work of Mead, which he took to be foundational, and also the history of the early Church. Newton's account of prophecy was based heavily on Mead, as he admitted, and it did tell of the rise and fall of the bestial Catholic religion. But the way he used Mead would have caused the merry old gent to turn in his grave. In Newton's scheme, all aspects of Trinitarian Catholicism were diabolical, and all the villains of Catholic and Protestant historiography were heroes. The real action centred on the 4th and 5th centuries after Christ was born. And for Newton, there was nothing special at all about the Reformation. He almost never talks about it. He almost never talks about Luther or Calvin. There was nothing of any great consequence for Protestantism about the images of the pouring of the vials, as it was for virtually every other Protestant interpreter. Instead, what Newton called correspondent vials and trumpets, that is, the first vial and the first trumpet, referred to the same event or period, though the timing of these did conform by and large to the dates given by Mead to the trumpets. For those still anxious to hold on to Newton, as in any sense like us, it's worth pointing out that he took a major consequence of his view to be that the intervals between the seven vials, trumpets and thunders, another vision in Revelation, spell out 666, which is yet another proof of the truth of Newton's theory. This is not very much like the kinds of demonstrations in the Principia Mathematica. Newton followed Mead in making the first five seals precede Constantine, while the opening of the sixth was fulfilled in Constantine's giving Christianity most favoured status within the Roman Empire. Soon after this, however, chronologically, Michael defeated the dragon in heaven, and the devil came down to earth, as Newton said, to play his cunning game. The devil came down to devour the man-child, or the true church, and to Newton it was obvious that the labour pains of the woman were the same as the battle between Michael and the dragon. The emergence of a western part of the Roman Empire following the latter's division on Constantine's death in 337 represented the appearance of the ten-horned beast, while the eastern empire represented the red dragon. In the confusion and babble of emperors that followed, Newton had exceptionally positive words for the two anti-Trinitarian emperors so hated by orthodox historiography, Constantius II and Valens, the former of whom wounded one of the heads of the beast, Newton thought, by suppressing orthodox Catholicism in the West. But the Catholic Trinitarians, led by Newton's archenemy Athanasius, had many victories, and the strange religion of worshipping saints and relics, as Newton put it, spread rapidly. This was the time when, as Newton put it, monkery gained ground and overran Christendom, and when senior theologians such as Jerome corrupted scripture by adding passages that gave scriptural support for the doctrine of the Trinity. After 250,000 words of definitions, analyses and proofs in one particular long manuscript written in the late 1670s or early 1680s, the Lucasian professor of mathematics, Isaac Newton, concluded that this emergence of an unprecedentedly perverse religion was the ascension of the beast from the bottomless pit. 250,000 words is much longer than the Principia Mathematica. For Newton, the opening of the seventh seal occurred when Trinitarian Christianity became the state religion in 380-381, and this ushered in the Great Apostasy, being the most notable of all changes that had ever taken place within Christianity. Now came the period of half an hour's silence, which you saw indicated by the non-trumpeting trumpeters earlier on, represented, as Newton saw it, by 15 years in which there was relatively little violence in the Roman Empire. The winds were held in check while the saints were sealed and numbered. As Newton, the posthumous son of a sheep farmer, put it, this was just as when a shepherd would mark and count the best sheep of his flock. He must separate them from the rest. So here, this sealing and numbering the saints must be an emblem of a separation then made in the church between them and the unfaithful. The anti-Trinitarians also had time to flee to the safe havens of neighbouring kingdoms of the godly and virtuous Goths and Vandals, where the true anti-Trinitarian religion was preached. Those left behind, according to modern dispensationalist theology, were abused and persecuted by sexually depraved monks and perverted rulers who combined an allegiance to the false religion with terrible luxury and profligacy. This was a proverbial calm before the storm, and now God exacted punishment on the idolaters who had so created an onslaught on Newton's heroes. After the half an hour silence finished in 395, the first trumpet was sounded. This had to be found, Newton thought, in the first notable invasion that occurred after the start of the seventh seal, and it constituted a violent wind from the east. The first major incursion, he thought, was by Alaric, king of the Visigoths, who reached Athens, while simultaneously a motley crew of Huns, Alans, and Ostrogoths, along with others, approached the Roman Empire from the other side of the Danube. These, along with Alaric's army, caused immense devastation along the way. These invasions, Newton wrote, continued in this deplorable state for 10 or 11 years, and the people proceeded not like generous conquerors, but they set themselves maliciously to lay waste all places and to do what misery they could. They were sent like furies from heaven to scourge the Romans. The second trumpet and vial depicted the terrible events leading up to the sacking of Rome in 410, but the Western Empire had settled down in relative tranquility when a series of major incidents occurred in Africa in the year 427, constituting the onset of the third trumpet and vial. The Vandals, now based in Spain, were invited into Africa by the Roman governor of that province, but they abused their host and took complete, as they were wont to do, by the way, and they took complete control, wreaking terrible devastation where they went. The king of the Vandals, Gaiseric, took Carthage in 438 and Sicily 2 years later in what Newton called a series of piratical incursions, and amongst other despicable acts, he set Attila the Hun and his family loose upon his rival, the Visigothic king Theodoric, to prevent the latter from taking revenge on Gaiseric for having cut off the nose of Theodoric's daughter. Small and ludicrous scale atrocities such as this could not dampen Newton's ardour for his heroes, and the Vandals' rise to glory culminated in the looting of Rome and other cities in 455, carrying, as Newton put it, into Africa the whole treasures thereof, and constantly of the empire, which the abstemious Goths had spared, captivating, Newton said, with exultation, the flower of Italy. After the pouring of the third vial, John, as you recall from Revelation, heard the angel of waters give thanks to God for having judged those who had shed the blood of saints and prophets. Newton saw this as the central part of the apocalypse. As he wrote, "This affords a third character of those times, and it's worthy of your special notice, namely that these wars followed upon a sanguinary persecution of the church, and they were inflicted upon the persecutors as a righteous judgment to shed their blood, who had shed the blood of saints, and thereby derived upon themselves the blood of all prophets and martyrs since the world began." This was the beginning of the anti-Christian persecutions that Newton found so deplorable, and whose beginnings could be found in the second vial in the time of the Emperor Honorius. It was, he said, that sort of persecution by which the beast made war with the saints and overcame them, that sort of persecution by which the whore of Babylon became drunken with the blood of saints and of the martyrs of Jesus. Hence these were the first to set on foot, as Newton said, those bloody persecutions which have been exercised in Europe and continue in the Roman Catholic Church to this day. Getting into his stride, Newton argued that there was no barbarian nation so prosperous, domineering and cruel as the Vandals, and hence that the African persecutors had been dealt a terrible blow. God showed his justice in a more special manner, Newton said, recompensing them with persecution for persecution. He followed this with a long description from the Catholic Victor's History of the Vandalic Persecutions, of the terrible trials and tribulations suffered by Catholics under the lash of the Vandals, who, to Newton's sanctimonious amusement, used the very same laws enacted by the Roman emperors against Catholics themselves. On the whole, Newton said, the barbarian persecutions enacted by the Huns and others were seldom for religious reasons, and even when they were, there were extenuating circumstances. As in other cases, the primary evidence provided by Victor of atrocities against Catholics was grist in Newton's mill. Unable to believe or accept that Catholics were brutalised for their profession of a religion he took to be false and diabolical, they were, for Newton, idolaters and libertines, the rightful victims of a vicious but godly barbarian horde. For Newton, Gaiseric's 50-year reign of terror constituted one continual lash to the wicked Catholics, so much so, he wrote, that some of that party, i.e. Catholics, like Baronius and others, have not shrunk to call him Antichrist. But his banishment of priests Newton took as a persecution for ill manners rather than for religion, since Gaiseric did not prohibit the practice of their religion by any law. Moreover, the insolence and perversity of the Africans, reported by Victor himself, excused the Vandals and Gaiseric in particular. Gaiseric's son and successor Huneric was initially more lenient, calling home all the banished priests and allowing them freedom of worship. But he purged his court and army of Trinitarians, and thereafter spoiling those he found there, on what further motive I know not, of their estates, and banishing them into Sicily and Sardinia. What could have caused Huneric to banish them? Huneric caused their sacred virgins, or nuns, Newton said, to be gathered together and searched by midwives, and for unchastity they were hung up with great weights tied to their feet, and they were burned with red-hot iron plates applied to various parts of their bodies, and in their torments they were urged to confess their defilers. A number of deaths and deformities resulted from this torture, and Newton admitted that it was quite severe. But, he continued, I wonder not much at the numbers that suffered when I consider what Salvian, a Catholic historian, has written of the extreme and universal unchasteness of the Africans, where the Vandals cured it not by causing marriage. Seeing prohibition without grace does but inflame the desire. After this, 5,000 priests, deacons, bishops and monks were banished to the desert. What could have caused this? What crime the Vandals charged them with to select them out of the rest, Victor hides, Newton says. Their faith alone it could not be, because they were persecuted for that after this, Newton said. Rather, the expulsion of the clerics was clearly connected to the examination by the midwives of the nuns. I cannot but suspect, he said, it was chiefly, if not solely, the result of their confession. The old men among them were once young enough. And although Victor minces the matter, he tells us the Vandals examined the nuns to find occasion of animadverting upon the clergy. And amid so many tortured and defiled nuns, tortured to confess, it's impossible but confessions must be made. And why not some at least true as well as false? Yet all are saints with Victor, not an ill confession, not a stain to his church, not a crime acknowledged in his own party in all his history. Nothing there but saints. Nor a punishment, be it for what it will, but makes a martyr or a confessor if inflicted by a Vandal. And it will go too hard if his saintship be not recommended by a miracle or two. This is obviously the mark of a radical anti-Catholic Puritan, just in case you hadn't noticed. For Newton, the evidence was overwhelming that the African Roman Catholics had become indefensibly wicked, being almost without exception prone, as he said, to lechery, lying, deceit, violence, insolence, pride, malice and injustice. All these crimes were enough to give the opportunity for Victor's martyrs to suffer at the hands of the Vandals. In all these atrocities, Newton saw the hand of Providence at work. God, he said, permitted the restorations of the Roman African Church, as it were, so that they could, by iterated persecution, suffer again and again what they inflicted once upon the true Church. These remarkable passages have never been published fully in print, nor have they been seen by more than two or three people since they were written, although for over a year they've been available online via the Newton Project. However unpalatable Newton's views to a modern audience, they display the brilliant scholarship of a moral Puritan and religious heretic whose interpretation of Scripture had become a way of life. Composed in the late 1670s or early 1680s, it's impossible to tell, there's no evidence at all in these writings of any concern with contemporary events. Newton did, however, actively oppose the regime of the Roman Catholic James II, and he was forced to appear before the hanging judge, Judge Jeffreys, in May 1687, down in London. One of his major treatises on Revelation, however, was written in the hand of his secretary, who made copies of the draft of the Principia and was with him from 1684 to 1690. In these masses of writings, there is the stultifying example of hundreds of thousands of words examining the internal order of Revelation, with not even the relief of linking the prophecies to historical events. In all this, there are occasional links to the real world, such as when Newton writes over the handwriting of his secretary to make it clear to the non-existent reader to whom the apocalyptic warning against idolatry referred. This is I'll leave that one out. This is the text. This is in the writing of his Principia Amanuensis, Humphrey Newton. And Newton has written over it. This is talking generally about sorcery and magic, and Newton has written over it to make it absolutely clear to talking about Agnus Dei's, Psalters, rings, dead wooden crosses, and so on and so forth, and continues on the back page. He makes it clear that this is a reference to the Roman Catholic Church. And there's a lovely piece up the top there. He says, to make the figure, to make such figures is innocent, but to place a supernatural power in them is sorcery, be it any religion whatever. And Christians who do so are sorcerers, though they do not know it. There's a clear reference to contemporary Catholicism. Occasionally, however, a great discovery on a par with universal gravitation, this written, as I said, at exactly the same time as he writes the Principia, a great discovery sometimes reveals itself in his writings, such as Newton's extraordinary assertion that would have been seen as absurd by his contemporaries, that the woman in the wilderness had degenerated into the whore of Babylon, which in this writing Newton takes to be his great discovery. I wonder if that's the same kind of thing that we believe today. What kind of relevance do these writings have in the early 21st century? Are there any relevance? Is there any relevance at all? I want to conclude with two aspects of these extraordinary writings. There's nothing to conclude about these writings other than to say that Newton is a radical Puritan, if you like, stuck in his date of birth of 1642, writing in the 1670s and 80s. He writes in private. He writes for nobody that we know of. He writes for us, if you like. We're the first person to have read these writings. They're heretical, they're anti-Trinitarian, but in their animus against Catholics, they are things that you could have read in any number of writings, in the particularly in the early 17th and mid-17th centuries. In the first place, it's worth reiterating that I've used materials that are almost entirely available online, whether through the magnificently comprehensive Early English Books Online, EBO, or through the Newton Project, or via the John Fox Project at Sheffield University Humanities Research Institute, where they have all four major editions of Fox's Acts and Monuments online. There are differences between these forums. EBO and the John Fox Project have been involved in the digitisation of printed books, whereas at the Newton Project, John Young, Mike Hawkins, myself, and many others have been publishing material that is not so much born digital as born manuscript. It's striking that the online medium is an excellent forum for showcasing materials that are not printed, making them available, ironically, to tens of millions of people when authors such as Fox, Baxter, and Newton did not want them seen by anybody else. And as users of the web, and more recently, scholars in humanities more generally, if that's more generally than users of the web, have come to realise the online provision of materials is partly a transparent instrument for research and communication, but it's also increasingly a way of life. There are advantages and disadvantages with the new medium, but as a way of life, one suspects that academics will be continually adjusting to the effects of the digitisation of materials. Secondly, is the apocalypse relevant to us today? I speak as somebody who is not a believer. Excepting the 50 million dispensational evangelists who avidly consume the best-selling Left Behind series, outselling Harry Potter, by the way, in the American Bible Belt. It's about those people who are left behind when all the elect are raptured up. They still have to fight Antichrist, by the way, who's based in Romania. Excepting these 50 million evangelists, few now take seriously Fox or Mead or even Newton's views on Revelation. I do hope, by the way, that those 50 million dispensational evangelists will come to read our website. From another point of view, we are in danger of accidentally fulfilling many of its prophecies. As Frederick Buell has pointed out in his excellent book, From Apocalypse to Way of Life, we live in a world where apocalyptic language has become commonplace and indeed a way of life. I refer, of course, to environmental apocalypse, the slow burn of planetary destruction that, by all accounts, is already underway. There are many similarities between our own condition and that of the people in this study. We look for signs of how pollution and global warming are working their way in the world, and we worry incessantly about a future described rather well, if it turns out rather tamely, in the images of environmental destruction described in the trumpets and the vials. Who is to say that the images of glacial melting and desertification are not as bad as that depicted in the apocalypse, or that there will not be associated famines and diseases around the corner, accompanied, we may think, by four horsemen? These concerns are not those of fanatics, for we have to believe that a future is laid out that will affect all of us on earth. The apocalypse provided hope for some, whereas today there is widespread despair. Will being virtuous make any difference, or has fate already decreed a future? Should we, as James Lovelock, the author of Gaia, believes, party like it's 1999? Who are now the saints and martyrs amidst the cacophony of eco-apocalyptic rhetoric? And where is there any possibility of exile? Who will be saved? And will there be rivers or trees or 12 sorts of fruit for them to feed on? Thanks.